Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Holton Hay, your host. My guest is Tim Todd, author of A Great Moral and Social Force, A History of Black Banks. Tim is an executive writer and historian with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. He is the author of 8 books on the history of banking and financial services, including, of course, A Great Moral and Social Force. Prior to joining the Federal Reserve, Tim was a journalist for 10 years and spent another 5 years as a writer focused on fixed income markets. Now, A Great Moral and Social Force is written as a historical reference on Black community banks and serves as a guide to help all Americans think differently about our relationships with banks. The goal of the latest volume of the Kansas City Fed's historical book series is to move across eras and examine some of the communities where banks played a dual role in establishing both economic opportunity and social opportunity. So, Tim, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be joining you today.
Okay. The biggest question on my mind, having been familiar with the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas and did some things with them way back many years ago, I am pleasantly surprised that a Federal Reserve Bank is, and correct me if I'm wrong, sponsoring books about Black bank history. So talk a little bit about why the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City and you are so committed to writing about the history of Black banks.
So, thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about this and how the Fed got interested in this. And there's a couple things, and there's also then sort of how I got interested in this. But I'll start with the Fed's role as a central bank of the United States. Obviously, has concerns about the economy, has concerns about the ability of folks to access credit, borrow money on appropriate terms, and how that helps them improve their lives, helps the economy grow, helps people buy homes, gain further education, things like that. And so obviously there is known to many people, a long history of problems in many Black communities in accessing credit. So if you go out and you look at a map of where many of what we call alternative financial services providers or payday lenders are located, they very often locate in neighborhoods that have large minority populations. We also know that Black individuals and families are less likely to be fully banked than others. And so that means that either they are unbanked, completely out of the banking system, or they are underbanked, which means that they probably have a checking account, but they don't have a banking account. So they're going to borrow from one of those payday lenders or title loan type places. And then finally, the number of Black banks in the United States has been declining for some time. Over about the past 20 years, we've seen their numbers cut by more than half. I think there were 19 or 20 at the end of last year, from about 50 in the year 2000. And that's not reflective of what we've seen in other minority-owned depository institutions, or what we call MDIs. All of that is obviously concerning. We know that MDIs are key sources of credit in their communities. They primarily serve a minority customer base. When an MDI closes, it is unlikely to be replaced by another bank in serving that community. And so all of that, very concerning from the Fed's perspective as we think about the economy. For me personally, I'm concerned about those issues, but what really drove me to explore this history is my work at the Fed prior to recently had focused primarily on banking history, Federal Reserve history, kind of the history of monetary policy and how the Fed does some of its decision making. And over the years, as I was doing this research, I would from time to time come across a newspaper item in an old newspaper mentioning one of the early Black banks. And I was really interested. You know, these stories would kind of spark my interest. And I think, well, someday I want to learn more about this. And so I went out to Amazon, you know, like you do when you want to buy a book. And there weren't really any books out there. There weren't any resources out there. And so I really wanted to learn more of this history and recognizing all the issues as we think of access to financial services. It just really fit together for us to pursue this project and bring this history forward to folks.
So I'm looking at the cities that you selected: Richmond, Virginia; Boley, Oklahoma; Chicago, Illinois; Memphis, Tennessee; and Detroit, Michigan, the 5 cities that you decided to focus on in writing about the history of Black banks. What went into the selection of those 5 cities?
So what we were trying to do is we had published a book 2019 called Let Us Put Our Money Together. And it looked at specifically at the first Black banks. And those banks were created. Richmond, Virginia was really the heart of Black banking. And you had the development of the Jackson Ward neighborhood there. And people may be familiar with Maggie Walker and her history as a female banker in that community. She had a lot of national prominence. And so that was really the starting point. And so when we decided that we wanted to look more at this history and we wanted to move across time, we wanted to do it in a way that wasn't so much a directory, but it sort of moved forward in a narrative, because we want to reach people who aren't necessarily, economists, right? We're going for a very public audience with this, and we want to make this book really accessible to everyone. And so we thought it was important to sort of look at communities where we saw not only these banks at the heart of important economic development, but they also move forward in time. So you could sort of look at starting with that Richmond and the beginning there, then you could sort of follow the narrative forward through history. And so we go to Oklahoma after the failure of Reconstruction. There were about 50 Black communities created in Oklahoma. There were in other states of the Plains too, Kansas, Nebraska, a little bit in Colorado, but you saw a number of individuals and families move out of the South into the Plains to establish communities. And so that's an interesting history. People have become increasingly familiar with the story of Greenwood and Tulsa. And we talk about that, but we thought it was important to focus on Boley, an all-Black community created there around the turn of the century that was very well known nationally at that time. And then moving forward from there with the Great Migration to the North, increasing industrialization and looking at Chicago, and then beginning of the Civil Rights era, of course, Memphis being the key point there, and then Detroit following that Civil Rights era forward. So trying to tell a consistent narrative moving forward in time and then spotlighting some key places. There were certainly other cities. We could have looked at Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., maybe to a lesser degree, some of the things that happened in New York a little later in the time frame of the book. But those were kind of the cities we chose. We wanted to just kind of keep it workable and manageable for folks.
But the book opens up with Alden McDowell, president and CEO of Liberty Bank and Trust, headquartered in New Orleans. He's been the CEO since it was actually founded, I believe, in 1972, 1973. And he's in a cab with the cab driver who has payday loans. And Alden offers the solution. And that may be sort of the biggest challenge that I see today with underbanking. And I'm glad that term underbanking has become prominent, because when I first saw the movements to try to address the issue with the alternative financial sources, people basically go into payday loans and title loans, there was a lot of emphasis. All I heard was unbanked, unbanked, unbanked. But then now we're looking at people who are underbanked. They have a checking account. They may have a small savings account, but because of prior credit issues, they have now found themselves forced to go to the alternative financial sources like payday loans and car title loans. So talk about Liberty Bank and Trust, which is maybe one of the most successful Black-owned banks in the country, because it has stayed under the same ownership and the same leadership, and they have been acquiring banks across the country.
Yeah, I think today they are the second largest Black bank in the United States right now. Liberty was created, as you said, in the early 1970s in New Orleans. Alden is really a phenomenal individual. I've been fortunate to spend some time with him. We were together in Richmond. It was one of our times together. We actually toured Maggie Walker's house before the events that we talked about at the beginning of the book. Alden received a lot of national attention, or a significant amount of national attention, around Hurricane Katrina. And so if folks are interested in learning about his bank and some of the things he did, the New York Times followed him, and then some other media began to follow him and some things he was doing, helping the community there, helping people be able to get cash, without if they didn't have access to an ATM or didn't have access, the bank wasn't able to make sure that they had money in the accounts, but was able to help people access money. And it's kind of interesting that some of the things you saw Alden do during Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath, and some of the other things that he's engaged in, are very similar to some of the things you saw that we talk about in this history of some of these earliest banks. And so he's sort of carrying on some of those same traditions.
One of the interesting things about a lot of the banks, when you talk about the history of how they got started, is that they're started by entrepreneurs. people who are already successful in other lines of business. And if you look at, say, Unity National Bank here in Texas, in Houston, Texas, and that bank, I believe, originally started as Riverside National Bank, and it's gone through a couple of iterations, a couple of changes in ownership. But the current owner of that bank is a very successful, has a very successful company in the oil industry that traditionally has been on the Black Enterprise 100 and ended up taking control of that bank some years ago. So talk about how these individuals you saw as you studied the history of these Black banks and these communities, how they started off as successful entrepreneurs in other areas and then transitioned to starting banks to serve the community.
Right. So that's one of the things that I think is really interesting. Across this history, you don't see people open a bank coming from a background in finance. Almost across the board, they've come at it from some other industry. So if you look at somebody like Jesse Binga in the South Side of Chicago, Jesse had been successful in real estate. He sort of begins informally lending money to people, and eventually that evolves into banking. You see that sort of time and again. If you go back and you look at Richmond, William Washington Brown ran a fraternal organization. It was basically a very rudimentary insurance provider where there were small little chapters and people would pay in money, and then that money would be held by the chapter until a member had some type of family crisis, and then that money would be allocated to them. He recognized, hey, there's an opportunity. If we compile this money from our different groups, we can lend that money back out to the community. So you see people coming from non-banking backgrounds who are very often successful, and they come into banking, though, not with the idea of, hey, here's another way to make some more money. I can get rich. Time and again, you see people coming into banking because they see the value in serving the community. And I think that's really interesting as you think about, I think a lot of people today, when you sort of think of a banker, probably the stereotypical image that comes to mind is sort of the little guy from the Monopoly game board, right? The guy with like the top hat and whatever. These bankers are definitely not from that mold. These folks, time and again, come to banking because they see the value of what they can do for their communities. They are in a position, often financially, although not always, if you look at Boley, Oklahoma, and the creation of the community there, but they are able to bring folks together, bring the money together, and then use that money to lend it back out to the community and foster economic growth and additional opportunity.
One of the other things you noted about Binga Bank is that their earliest depositors were not just African-Americans, that whites accounted for perhaps as much as 2/3 of the initial customer base, which brings me to this point, that those banks that chose to serve the Black community, the level of capital needed for the additional risks that they're willing to take to serve the Black community. And even in today's environment with the, I was working with the NAACP Community Development Resource Center, national partnership between Nations Bank and the NAACP in the mid 1990s. And so I was there seeing the transition from decisions being made on who gets a loan, going from a committee to it being totally automated.
Right.
And bankers being discouraged from asking for an override of the automated system. Yet oftentimes the tools that are used to automate, in my humble opinion, are disadvantaged to the Black community because it doesn't take into account that rich history. And when you have those committees or individuals like Alden McDonald that understand the greater social forces at work and how to be successful to make those decisions, those are better for the Black community. However, they are more costly and less profitable.
Right. So what has happened? There is a regulatory environment right now in banking, which basically makes it very difficult for a bank to give weight to what we would call like soft information, right? So if you are a local community bank and someone comes into you and wants to borrow money and you know they are of good character and they are a real go-getter and they want to open a restaurant in our neighborhood and we know there's not a restaurant, so there's a big need and we think this is going to be successful. A lot of that information cannot be quantified with numbers, right? And so the way the regulatory environment is set up and the way many larger banks operate, frankly, is that they want that quantifiable sort of formulaic stuff like you were talking about. And so that makes it very hard for the bank to be able to extend credit. And so that creates any number of challenges for community banks. You know, community banks all over the United States, really their bread and butter is sort of doing that relationship-based lending. And it's become increasingly harder for them to do that. And then larger banks are going to look more at just sort of those metrics and those formulas and how do your numbers fit within certain parameters when they make their lending decisions.
But isn't it true also that the way that regulators look at your portfolio, that even if a loan is performing, if they don't like the way you underwrote those loans, that they could force you to write it off?
You know, I'm not involved enough in the regulatory side of the Fed to really be able to elaborate on kind of how.
We'll skip a question and maybe we'll get someone else who could answer that question in the future. But I think that the thing is that the Community Reinvestment Act passed by Congress in 1977, the CRA, to extend credit to the entire community to say, sir, to what degree, if you have knowledge of this, does it encourage the big banks to invest in minority depository institutions?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not an expert on the CRA, but I think it's, you know, as I think about the CRA and I think of being in communities, you know, if the banks are not in the communities, then it's not really doing a lot to encourage lending in those communities, right? Because it wants to make sure you're doing lending within your neighborhood and within the area you serve. So, but I'm not really fully versed on the CRA to get into an in-depth discussion on that.
And just for the people listening, he is a historian, he is a writer, so I am asking questions he had no idea was going to ask him. But one of the most interesting things you brought up in the book was the April 3rd Martin Luther King speech in Memphis, his famous mountaintop speech, I believe the day before he was assassinated back in 1968. And I quote from the speech that you quote, "We got to strengthen Black institutions. I call upon you to take your money out of the banks downtown and deposit your money in Tri-State Bank. We want a bank-in movement in Memphis. Go by the Savings and Loan Association. I'm not asking you something that we don't do ourselves in SCLC." So talk a little bit about your discovery of Martin Luther King in that 1968 speech encouraging the community to invest in Black banks.
Right. So a lot of, you know, I think a lot of people popularly, obviously, are very aware of Dr. King and a lot of the things he talked about. But I think some things kind of get overlooked. And he was talking about the importance of putting money in a Black bank that could help a community grow. Tri-State is actually the bank that's pictured on the cover of the book. But what he was trying to encourage, and he actually at one point considered trying to get a bank established, but obviously he has a lot going on, and that's quite a bit of work and dedication to put your focus to. But recognizing that the banks are the catalyst of economic opportunity, and the more money that goes into them, the more good they can do in terms of lending that money out. And so he was very much concerned about many of the issues. Obviously, with his remarks during that speech, which you shared, he was obviously very concerned about these issues and sort of economic equality, the opportunity that can come with that, and how important that is.
I do want to circle back around about the how it is costlier as a minority depository institution bank. You actually addressed this with comments made by Kenneth Kelly. He was is the chairman and CEO of First Independence Bank. And in 2019, he was testifying during a House Financial Services Subcommittee hearing on the decline of minority depository institutions. And in his testimony, as you write, he says that the bank is relatively small with limited resources to cover compliance costs. It is mission-driven and focused on low to moderate income communities, which can be costly to serve. The business model can often be at odds with the view of bank examiners who may be unfamiliar with the institution, and that the investor community may not see value in the bank's mission.
Right. So one of the things that I think he's alluding to there is when you are a bank and you are serving a low to moderate income community, the small dollar deposits are very costly, right? Because when you have this small amount of money, they're very costly for you to manage and service. And when you have frequent deposits and withdrawals, those aren't good sources of loanable funds. You need stable, long-term dollars in there so you can lend that money out. So that's a little bit of what he's talking about. And then going into the regulatory environment and sort of how that shapes and limits the opportunity to do business there. You know, one of the things we sort of talk about in the book also is how you need to be bringing, ideally, these banks want to bring in deposits from outside the community, right? You want to bring in extra dollars to the community so you can help lend that out. And so that sort of gets into this issue of, you know, a Black bank and how do banks serve communities in general and sort of how do you, what effect does that have?
So it sounds to me like one of the keys is with all that major corporations have committed to over the past couple of years because of the George Floyd issue and other just challenges that have occurred, corporate deposits and minority depository institutions may be one of the critical things that can help to enhance their ability to serve our communities. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I think so. This is something, you know, it's going to be important for it to be sustained. So we saw some of this in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and then it kind of faded away over time. We've seen more of it more recently. I think some banks have received more deposits than others. Obviously, that's going to happen. Overall, Black-owned banks are still very small when we think about the banking landscape and some of the large, what are often referred to as the too big to fail banks that we see on, you know, every street corner, pretty much in the United States. These are community banks. These are smaller institutions. Those things can make a difference. Also, you know, people borrowing money from those banks. You saw, or maybe you didn't, but recently Major League Soccer borrowed some money or set up some financing through a network of minority-owned depository institutions. So that helps, right? As a bank grows its profits, it can turn that money into additional opportunity. So I think things like that are very important as you think about bringing money in from outside the community, bringing new money in to help the community that can be dedicated to growth opportunities there.
The book both opens and closes with statements written by the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. And I thought one of the interesting about her background, and of course, my frame of reference is always looking at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. And what I've seen with the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, we're bringing in new people to become president. They come from the outside, they become president. They come from the outside, they become president. They come from the outside, they become president. Whereas the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City actually has spent almost her entire career, I believe, yeah, with the Kansas City Federal Reserve. And so in my mind, at least, what that means to me is when you've spent your entire career with that bank, you have a much better understanding of the importance of these banks to those communities, and you are embedded in those communities, and you have that knowledge that is coming with being there for 20, 25, 30 years that, frankly, I don't think you can get if you just come from the outside and you come in and you're president for 5 years and you go on to your next job.
Well, I think one of the strengths of a bank president, Esther George, is she came up through the regulatory side. She was a bank examiner early in her career. And so she was literally going into banks and talking with bankers and sitting down, looking at the books, understanding, you know, the risks they were taking, how they were managing those risks. And I think that perspective is really important. I think when a lot of people, you know, think of the Federal Reserve, they think of the FOMC and the monetary policy work. And obviously that's hugely important to the economy. But an understanding of regulation can be really helpful, especially when you've been, you know, out in the communities, actually talking with the bankers, making those sort of local connections are really important. And we're in a part of the country where we have a lot of small banks. We have a lot of Native American banks, actually, in the region we serve. We serve Oklahoma. There's a number of Native American banks there. So familiarity with some of the issues those banks face can be very helpful.
One of the things that is a bit of a light, despite the fact that we have so many banks that have closed the doors over the past 20, 30 years, is when Black-owned banks come in, like Liberty Bank and Trust from New Orleans, Louisiana, to take over these banks. So it's not always lost if we lose that bank if we have Black banks who have that understanding coming in to take over those banks. Do you agree?
Right. Yeah. So some of the loss, right, is going to be from consolidation, and some of those, several cases, Liberty has made some acquisitions. Other times, that's not the case. Obviously, there are economies of scale, and so when Liberty comes in or somebody else comes in and makes an acquisition, if they understand and if they're engaged in the business, then that can be potentially beneficial. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes it gets acquired by someone else who has other interests for the bank or other ideas. That happens as well. So, you know, it kind of depends, but it certainly can be beneficial as we see the banks get a little larger.
So I want to close our discussion to talk about rap.
Okay.
Specifically to talk about Killer Mike. Michael yeah. Render, who became well-known activist for Black banking. So my most important question to ask you, Tim, is did you know who he was before he went on the crusade?
So I did. So I did not. I was not familiar with him, but I have spent considerable time going back and reviewing many interviews that he did and some of the things he talked about. And I find him fascinating. I've watched his Netflix series. I listened to his music. I think that he
wait. I got to stop you there. I want you to say that again. You listen to Killer Mike's music?
Yes, yes, of course. So one of the things that I think people would be, everyone would be well suited, I think, to listen to what he is saying, and I think that. With some audiences, probably his rap background, I think it makes it easy or tempting for people to discount him. And I think that is a mistake. As we talk about in his bio, he is well versed in everything that he is talking about. And so I felt it was important to include him in the book and talk about what he's doing and what he's trying to do. Now, he's not in a position of creating an actual bank yet. You know, he's sort of on that path, I think. What he's talking about doing is creating an app-based or an online system that can take deposits. It's not going to be in a position to lend, so it's not technically going to be a bank. But that's going to help some people. It's going to bring people who are outside the financial system, is going to bring them closer into the mainstream financial system. And hopefully that will be able to evolve into a bank that's able to do the lending and all those types of things. So, anything that gets people out of being unbanked, in my view, is probably good.
And I think the other more important thing also to say is to be unbanked or get them from being underbanked and recognizing the importance of being able to make the transition to not being dependent on the alternative financial sources.
Right. And when you get involved with them, you know, it's going to create problems for you building a credit history. It's going to introduce a downward spiral of debt very potentially. And you can go online and read all kinds of stories about that. You know, one of the things the earliest banks did was really, you know, reached out to people and were like, hey, just if you only have a few dollars or a few cents, just start making regular deposits and start building that relationship. And that can be really important. You know, I tend to talk a lot about borrowing money to buy a house or get an education or things like that, right? But, you know, sometimes the refrigerator breaks and you got to come up with some cash to get it fixed or buy a new one. And so it's not just about borrowing, you know, money to buy a home. It's borrowing, you know, $1,000 or less to be able to get the refrigerator up and running or to make sure that, you know, the roof isn't leaking in your house. I mean, it's small things like that happen where if you've got that banking relationship, that's going to help you at a time of emergency.
And where can they get the book? Because it is free. How can they get
it? You can go to KansasCityFed.org. That's our website. And you can go out there and download a PDF. Or if you want, just give us your address. There's a form you can fill out and we will send it to you free of charge.
Tim Todd, author of A Great Moral and Social Force, A History of Black Banks. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review, the podcast.
I appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.